day a mother went to a prison to see an erring but precious son.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KABU program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Sarah McCall, author of the new memoir, Joy Enough, in conversation with Margaret Malone, author of the story collection, People Like You. Sarah was founding editor-in-chief of Yahoo Food and holds an MFA from Sarah Lawrence College. Her essays have appeared in the Paris Review, Story Quarterly, and McSweeney's, and she's been a McDowell Fellow and Pushcart Prize nominee. Joy Enough, published by Live Right, is Sarah's first book. Margaret is a Portland-based writer and teacher and has published work in the Missouri Review, the Rumpus, Oregon Humanities, Paper Darts, and the Masters Review. Her story collection, People Like You, published by Atelier 26 Books, was a finalist for the 2016 Penn Hemingway Award for First Fiction and winner of the Balcones Fiction Prize. In the words of writer Molly Weisenberg, Joy Enough is a diamond in book form, a beauty forged by the weight of loss and learning. It stunned me with its taut clarity and the way it probes quietly, gently, unflinchingly, the parts of life that a lot of us don't like to look at. Death, divorce, the pleasures and pitfalls of the body. McCall has a rare talent and it shines. Let's join Sarah and Margaret as they talk about Joy Enough, mothers, marriage, and memoirs.
Hello. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Margaret.
So first, just like, so where are you from? Where were you raised?
I was born in Dallas, Texas, and my dad's from West Texas. He's from Midland, and my mom's from Western Massachusetts. So there was sort of a cultural collision there in Dallas between the two of them. And I stayed there until I was 10 and then moved to Western Mass with my mother. There was a lot of moving around to New Jersey and then college in Minnesota and all about.
Yeah. And then you stayed, did you stay on the East Coast for a while?
Well, I went to high school in New Jersey and then college in Minnesota. And then I moved back to New York after college because I didn't know what else to do with myself, sort of. and I was there for 14 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So adult life, I mean, that makes me official. I'm an official New Yorker is what they say. 10 years and you're in.
Is that what they say?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
God, in Portland, it's like 20 years. but are you from Portland? Like, then you'll never be from Portland.
Yeah. That's a high bar.
It's brutal. I know. Anyway. So, and were you writing that whole time? Like, were you one of those, like, I've been writing since I was 5 and
as a child,
never stopped? And
kind of. I mean, I remember this fifth grade project where, well, I had a third grade project where we were supposed to write little biographies of our parents, and I interviewed my mother. And then in fifth grade, I think my writing changed into my parents were getting divorced and life felt out of control, but writing was the one thing that I could control. So it became a kind of rehearsal almost. Like, here's how I want things to turn out. Mm-hmm. So I remember writing a story about, you know, parents getting divorced and a family moving to Western Massachusetts, but it was all okay because this girl got a new bike that was red and a library card in this new town and it all turned out fine. So I think that was kind of my approach to writing, was some sort of almost like mental rehearsal for how I wanted things to be, which sounds like I should have written fiction, but maybe there's hope for me still.
I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
And so when do you feel like in your heart of hearts you started writing this book, Joy Enough?
I guess technically probably in graduate school, but maybe also slightly before that, in the sense that I've always been a journal writer. And so I had notes during the time. Part of the book is about going and spending time with my mother at her house and caring for her. And I was taking a lot of notes at that time. But that just felt more like keeping a diary. And I don't think it was that I was consciously writing a narrative about her until I went to graduate school. And that was in 2014.
And she, was she sick then already, or was she?
She had died by the time grad school. Yeah.
Okay. When did your husband, ex-husband, have that? What he said to you about who you're really writing about? When did that?
Well,
what did he say, and when did he? Yeah. Say it.
Well, so he had said, probably, I don't know, in 2009 or something.
A long time ago.
Well, I should back up and say I used to write a blog. I had a blog that was about, it was basically an excuse to explore my emotional life and how I thought being an adult was hard. And
how old were you when you were writing this
blog? I started it when I was like 24, 25, uh-huh. somewhere around there. Uh-huh. I had my first job in New York. Uh-huh. I was like, man, this is a slog. No one cares about what I'm thinking. They just want me to photocopy this manuscript. I was working in publishing. And I was just, it's the first job experience that everyone needs to have. But I needed some kind of creative outlet. So I started a blog. But it was kind of just like, oh, adult life is hard and I'm sad. Here's a deep rumination about my feelings. And here's a lentil soup recipe at the end. It kind of made no sense. But that was when I started thinking about kind of what are the qualities of daily life that can keep me focused in the sense of optimistic, I guess. Mm-hmm. What are the qualities of daily life that can keep me optimistic? Because mm-hmm. daily life actually seems really hard. I kind of think that I'm like a depressive optimist.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I have often called myself a pessimistic optimist.
Yes.
Because at root, I am an optimist, but most of the day I spend being pessimistic.
Yeah. I completely
relate
to that. Yes, yeah. I do. Like, I feel like all my optimism is a direct reaction to my not wanting to be depressed. It's like, you know. So, mm-hmm. so I tried to write and publish a book that was basically a lifestyle book. You know, it had craft projects, more lentil soup recipes. And, you know, it went, like, pretty far along in the sense that I'd written a proposal and I had meetings. And I was like, wow, this is great. And it didn't sell. And I was devastated at the time. This was in 2008, I think. No one was selling anything. Yeah, so it was 2008. Yeah. That's what it was. It was 2008. And I remember my mother at the time was like, you know, you're in your 20s. Do you really think that, like, the world needs to hear from you? And I was like, geez, Mom, but maybe you're right.
What do you think about that advice now?
I mean, I think it's funny because I'm so glad I didn't write that book. Yeah. I'm so glad that my first book was not a craft book. I'm so glad that I didn't try to make all my creativity and artistic ambition fit into the box of a lifestyle book, mm-hmm. because that would have been kind of, I think, selling myself short. But I didn't have the confidence at 27 or 28 or however old I was then to say, this is what I want to write. And I also didn't have the experience to write something else, you know? So it was all good that it didn't sell and it didn't happen. But I remember my now ex-husband at the time saying, you know, the real thing you want to write about is your mother.
You were writing about her in the blog intermittently?
Yeah, she'd come up.
Kind of like weave her way in.
Totally, because she taught me how to cook and and she really believed in kind of, she was a, I would say, practitioner of that kind of art of the everyday stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So we bonded over that.
So once you actually officially started working on it, what was allowable to you? What was okay to write about?
It's so funny. Like, I don't even think this way.
Yeah.
You know? I didn't even ask myself that question. I don't think I'm thinking about an audience in that concrete of a set. I'd never written a book before, so I didn't know where it would end up. So what would be allowed? You know what I mean? Like, who would stand in the way, or who would say, no, that's mine, that's not yours? So I guess I thought it was all fair game.
Yeah.
But that's is that uncommon?
I think that's very uncommon. Mm. Yeah. from people that I've talked to, and especially students, mm-hmm. that I always have questions. But it made me wonder if part of that, having read the book, comes from your mom, who, it, like, my take on reading it is, like, everything was allowable with her. Like, you were allowed all kinds of things. And it made me wonder, like, to be all kinds of ways is what I mean. Like, mm-hmm. to feel all kinds of feelings that I feel like other parents and moms, especially with daughters, would be like, well, like, there's a time and place for that.
Or right.
We don't talk about that now. Or it felt like my take on her was that she was a very, like, things were allowed. We were, like, you were allowed.
Yeah. So my older sister is also a writer.
I didn't know that.
And an editor.
Okay.
Yeah, she wrote for Jane Magazine. Did
oh,
you
yeah.
read that
I
back in the day?
Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My older brother has a creative spirit. It manifests, I think, in his dancing hobby. But
ooh, that's
yeah.
I want to dive.
but a practical. He has a practical job, but he's the only one. And my little brother is an actor, and people used to kind of say to our mom, like, why did you encourage your kids to have these really outlandish and impractical careers? And she said, well, I don't have to say no. The world will say no. And I think that was kind of her philosophy in some way was I don't need to preemptively squash what kids might want to do or what might be allowed. Like, if something's not allowed, I, Sarah, am going to get the sense of that pretty darn fast. And it might not be from her. It might just be from someone else, like the world
the
at
world.
Large.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is unusual because I think most parents are very afraid of their kids being hurt or disappointed. So they kind of are coaching them maybe to not put it out there so much.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like a trust issue, which I feel like must originate with her. So she must have trusted herself in the world in some way in order to imbue that with you. Like, I know as a parent, that's like, yeah, you are always like, be careful.
Right.
Because you're worried about them. But I stood next to a parent one time who was like, why do I even bother saying be careful? Is that going to change them trying to jump off the log onto
right.
the wall?
Right. Like,
it's not.
Right.
So why even bother saying it?
I think she wasn't very closely like monitored as a kid. She was one of five and she was the oldest. And I think she kind of just did her own thing. And I think doing her own thing, she found a lot of success. Like, one thing about my mom that I think is really impressive is that she grew up in this, rural town in Western Massachusetts, and she won the Procter & Gamble scholarship. So it's like a full ride anywhere, including book money and spending money. And so she went to Smith College down the road. Yeah. But I think that probably gave her the sense that, you know, she'd been a bit of an oddball in her high school, doing her own thing, doing whatever she thought was allowed, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of got her somewhere good.
What did she have to do to win that scholarship?
I have no idea. I wish I knew. She probably, like, I think it was probably based on grades and SATs, and then maybe she wrote some silly essay, which I would love to know what it was.
But that's got to exist somewhere.
I wonder. I should ask. My aunt probably knows the story of that scholarship. But there is like a family lore story about my grandfather going to the feed store, because he was a dairy farmer, going to the feed store in Pittsfield, which was like the nearer. Yes.
Is.
Okay. So it's
apple
like the bigger.
Donuts.
Exactly. So he's in Pittsfield buying some, like, a rake or something at the feed store, and the proprietor says, you know, did you hear about the girl from Williamstown who won the big scholarship to Smith? And he says, yeah, that's my oldest girl. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Did she ever think of going to Williams? Because since Williams was so
it
close,
was all not? Men at the time. So she used to always say that she didn't do study abroad. She did study abroad.
Oh, my God.
So she did, like, her junior year. This is how she actually – I'm glad we're getting to talk about this. It's probably totally off topic. But it's interesting in the sense that all the schools that are now co-ed were still only men. And so my mom met my dad because of this two-week – they called it an experiment in coeducation, where women applied to Ivy League schools, and she went to Princeton for 2 weeks. And the idea was to find out, like, can men concentrate if there are women around? Oh, and, you know, I guess they could, to some degree. And that's how she met my dad. And then her junior year, she spent the whole time at Williams.
Wow. I love how it wasn't like, can women concentrate?
Right. Exactly. Like, I mean, this is also her version of telling me what it was like. But
I think that's probably, that seems right, though.
It's cool, though. It was, I've always been fascinated by her college years, because she started in 68 and then she graduated in 71. When she started school, she said, you know, there was a house mother and you couldn't have a man in your room. And if you did, you had to leave the door open and there had to be 3 feet on the floor. Like, you can do a lot with 3 feet on the floor. But anyway, that was a rule.
That's true.
And then she said, by the time she graduated, they just wanted you to pay 50 cents to wash the sheets. So it was like a real, wow, you know, time of rapid change. But anyway, yeah. maybe that fed into some of her sense of what was allowable,
yeah,
you know, too. To bring it back to allowability.
Yes, thank you. I just, like, it just seems like such a gift, I feel like, and it comes through in the book. And she comes through so much in the book. Like, I just, the way, and so one of my favorite things about the book is the way the beginning of the book is narrated. So it's your voice as a narrator, and then it's sort of interwoven with your mother's voice. And at times it's like it's in your mother's POV, point of view, actually, like a third-person point of view. And then it's sort of woven in with, like, you as a narrator remembering things she told you. And it sort of is this beautiful, like, tapestry that's created of the two of you feel very united in telling the story. And then when she dies, her absence is so palpable because her voice isn't there except exclusively through you remembering things that she said.
Right.
And so it just feels so, and then the reader sort of feels what it feels like to have had that and then to have lost it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, it's heavy.
It sounds heavy.
It's heavy and light at the same time. It's weird because the things that come through her, through you and her voice, are remarkable. Like, okay, so now I'm going to read some of them because, like, I love them so much. I wanted her to be my mom. Okay. My favorite, no offense, mom. My favorite, I love this. Like, this, can someone put this, like, on a plaque? This is a quote from your mom, I think. Pursue happiness, pleasure, and sensual delight. Cook, ride your bike, pick out your spring clothes. Just live harder. That is the medicine.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, she was really into that stuff, having fun. And, I mean, the thing that always gets me, too, in terms of, this goes back to what you're saying, but also allowability. She had this index card on the refrigerator that said, good judgment is based on experience. Experience is based on bad judgment. So there was this sense that, like, you're going to mess up. And actually, that's part of figuring it out. And
it's allowed.
It's allowed. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's allowed.
Yeah.
In fact, it might even be, like,
encouraged.
Yeah.
Which is, that's right. That's basically evolution. I mean, that is the propagation of the species in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
We just mess it up till we get it right enough so that it's innate, and then we move on and we advance.
Yeah, but you're right. That is really unusual. And it is a gift. And I don't think I realized how unusual it was at the time. And one thing that I've been realizing kind of as the book has made its way into the world and talking to people is that one thing that was allowed is really feeling your feelings and expressing them and being interested in emotional life. And I had no idea that everyone wasn't walking through life this way. Like, oh, just really enraptured with your own kind of emotional response to things. But not everyone is doing that, Margaret.
No. No, most people are taught, especially in America, it's like with the Puritan background here.
Yeah.
I think so many are like, keep it, like, shh.
Right,
keep
right.
it locked up. That's for you, like, behind a closed door.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, it's huge. And I feel like particularly, like, from a mother to a girl,
yeah.
I feel like that's it's huge. It's really big. I feel like it's shifting now, but I feel like then it was unique, and I think it created an opportunity for an exploration of that question of like, what is it to be a woman, and how do you be a woman, which mm-hmm. are the two questions that I feel like this book comes back to again and again and again and constantly chews on. And like, there are some realizations, I feel like, at the end of the book, but nothing that can't be furthered.
Mm.
And I love that. And it did make me wonder, I kind of wanted to know, like, what do you think? I want to know your mom's take on what's your mom's answer to that question, how to be a woman. And I'm also curious about what your answer is to that question and perhaps how it has changed over time.
My mom wrote this letter to my sister that I found. My sister had to get orthodontia or something, mm-hmm. and she didn't want to, and she felt like there was this overemphasis on her looks in order to, you know, that she had to get her teeth straightened so that she could look better. And my mother wrote back I guess my sister ran away and left a note like, mm-hmm. I'm not getting this, and stop putting your patriarchy on me. And my mother wrote back like this 4-page single spaced letter about the patriarchy,
wow.
about standards of beauty, about the pressures of growing up in Dallas, Texas, where there were certain cultural forces that I think are unique around looks and women and femininity that were odd to my mother because she hadn't grown up there. And it ends with her saying, you know, thank you for giving me this opportunity to reflect on what it has meant to be a woman coming to terms with never being beautiful, to a young woman who is coming in to her own beauty or something
wow.
like that. And
goodness.
There's so many things that I think are interesting about this letter, one of which is just how seriously she kind of took up her 15-year-old daughter's anger.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I guess it wasn't really just about her 15-year-old daughter's anger. It was about her own anger and disappointment. But then the other thing that always strikes me is that line at the end. You know, a woman coming to terms in midlife with never having been beautiful. So this is a roundabout way of saying, I think my brother and I have talked about, there was kind of an overemphasis on looks, I think, in our family.
Mm-hmm.
So-and-so was so beautiful, or isn't so-and-so so beautiful? Kind of came up a lot. Why am I saying all of this? I have no idea.
Well, this is really interesting to me. I'm going to make you answer the other question again, too. But it's interesting to me because I've heard you say that, like, that your take on part of your mother's understanding of what it was to be a woman had to do with motherhood,
mm-hmm.
And like taking that role on, and that feels totally different
mm-hmm.
to me than that. It feels that so that's like what do you do with that?
And I think both of those things are true. And I guess for her, and I guess that is in some ways what I struggle with, and am trying to make sense of at least towards the end of the book, is that her idea of being a woman was in some ways very traditional. You know, these ideas of beauty and motherhood and children and creating beauty in the home and having family life and all of that. But in this other way, I think she was kind of radical in the sense that while she was attuned to beauty, she was also very aware of taking pleasure in oneself, in one's own body, and in feeling good about, you know, looking in the mirror, even if she didn't think she was beautiful sometimes. I guess she would find pleasure. There was this real sense of pleasure in embodied life. So that feels radical in the face of, like, are you beautiful? Are you traditionally beautiful or mm-hmm. something?
So then I'm just curious to take that back to sort of the original root of that question, which is, so how to be a woman?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really curious then how your mom's aversion of answering that question informed or didn't inform what it means, like, how would you answer that question? And has that changed over time as you've gotten older?
So I think that what I've gotten from my mother about how to be a woman or what being a woman is that I hold on to and that I retain and don't challenge now is this, that it is kind of like an act of rebellion in some way to take pleasure in one's own embodied form, you know, like mm-hmm. I am going to feel good. It's an act of resistance on some level, like in this culture, to
absolutely
to feel good in your skin and to walk around with that private knowledge, or even to make it public on some sense. So I do think that's radical of her, and I like all of that, and I work hard to kind of enact it because mm-hmm. it's difficult. But, and this is the big but, I think she had very, like, sort of essentialist ideas about women are like this and men are like this. And this is how men and women are different. And the older I get, I just, that doesn't feel true to me, you know? Like, I don't want to, and it feels so basic to realize this about myself, that I had taken in these very traditional ideas that I'm only realizing now, like, oh, why did I think when I got married I was in charge of dinner? You know, like, why did I think that? I'm not, you know. But it's taken me a long time to even realize that those were ideas that I had taken up. Mm-hmm. So what is my answer? I mean, I guess I'm just trying to say that I love all those hyper feminine kind of expressions that my mom kind of embodied of being a woman. And I think motherhood is important, and I love beauty in all its forms. But I also don't want to make dinner every night. I want to be, well, okay, here's the thing. Lately, I've been experimenting with being unlikable. Mm-hmm. Like, women are so trained to be likable, right?
And pleasant
uh-huh. and making everyone uh-huh. else feel good. Yeah. And it occurred to me recently, what if I didn't try to be likable? Like, what would my personality be like? And what's the worst thing about not being liked? And do I care? So thinking about some of these things, you know, because I'm realizing I'm quite angry.
Yeah.
And it is kind of like a moment of female rage that I'm really into.
Have you read that? Have you read the Lacey Johnson kind of essay called On Likeability?
No.
It's up at Tin House. It was a speech that she gave, like a lecture she gave uh-huh. at the Summer Writers Workshop. I would encourage you.
Okay.
Lacey
Done.
Johnson, On Likeability. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember seeing a writer say that at a talk, like, that she thought being likable was the first step to being heard as a woman.
Yes.
And I thought, well, that's really interesting, and I don't want that to be true. Mm-hmm. And so, I guess this is a long way of saying I don't think my mom had gotten necessarily to thinking some of these things. She might have been practicing them in her life, in that, like, you know, she could be brassy and ask for what she wanted and stuff. But she probably always did it with a wink and a smile. Mm-hmm. And
right.
I'm getting a bit tired of some of the performance, I guess, of femininity. Uh-huh. It's fun if you choose it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to have to choose it.
Yeah.
I want it to be a choice.
Yeah. Yeah. So that thing about, like, you thought you had to make dinner when you got married.
Yeah.
So that is just reminding me that sort of actually the book is really two things. And one is your mother's sort of illness and death, and the other is the sort of falling apart and disillusion of your marriage. And I'm really curious what it was like, could you write about both those things at the same time, or did you sort of have to compartmentalize them? And, like, when you were writing about your marriage falling apart, you could only write about that. If you're writing about your mom, you could only write about that. Or
yeah, I definitely did them separately.
Yeah.
Because I had very pretty much positive feelings about the time that I'd spent with my mother, even when she was dying, and pretty not positively about the time when my marriage was falling apart. And that was really the realization, was that the time that I spent with my mom, as she was very sick, felt so fun and alive. You know, she taught me how to like take over her garden that year, and I was cooking for her a lot, and we were having great conversations at the dinner table. And the time with my ex-husband, who was, you know, very much alive and healthy, and I was too, it was so heavy by comparison. And so that was like a very marked contrast, yeah, side by side. So, but I did have to write them separately.
And so going back to that kind of early question of what is allowable, does the answer to that change when you think about the sections you had to write about your ex-husband and your marriage falling apart? Or what does your original answer, does it hold?
Yeah. I mean, I had an anxiety dream where I got an all caps email from him. You know when you look at your iPhone,
yes,
and it has like the preview uh-huh. of the first line, and I did have an anxiety dream where I saw like the first line preview, and it was in all capital letters. So, yeah, I'm worried. I worry about his response. He's also a creative person, and he made a movie when we were still together that features a character like me, and I wasn't asked about that. So, mm-hmm. you know, I also sort of hope that to some degree his – well, let me take a step back. Let me take a giant step back and say that there's abstraction that happens even when you're writing about real people, you know. And so even though that's me on the page, it's also – a persona version of me. It's a literary rendering of a real person. And so, you know, anytime you take experience and you turn it into an aesthetic experience, lived experience into aesthetic experience, it changes it. And I don't expect every reader to think about that, like, oh, well, this isn't like a court document about how the end of their marriage went down. But I hope that people do, you know, keep in mind that it's just my version. It's the way I felt about it.
So that leads me to another kind of like craft question, which I get constantly, but I can't not, like from students, but I can't not ask, which is, so memoir, how do you handle dialogue? So some of it clearly, like, is it some of it from memory? Is some of it from like repetition of storytelling? Some of it just like straight up invented from what probably was said? Just curious, since everything's allowable,
right?
As you sit down to write, how do you handle dialogue?
That's a great question. I do keep a lot of notes, and so like in my diary, I will write down what people said. So it's a combination of all the things that you just said. Mm-hmm. Some dialogue is things that people say over and over again that you remember. A lot of things probably that my mom say in the book are her kind of pieces of advice that she said over and over. So some of it is I've written down and I have in notes, and mm-hmm. some of it is remembered. But I don't think I really will invent full-on things, but I might have. But then one wonders about, you know, recall.
Of course.
Yeah. So like I have memory about what people have said to me,
right,
but they, I'm sure, probably remember it differently.
Yeah.
So that's troublesome. But what are you gonna do? Like go and talk to every person and be like, "Is this what you said? Is that what you said?"
And they'll all have a different answer.
And they'll have a different answer. And then what do you do with that? It seems like a big old mess.
Yeah. And in some ways, that's really, I feel like, irrelevant, since a memoir is about a particular, like, a story told from a particular person's
yeah.
point of view, which is, that's part of the contract when you sit down, right? Is like, this is what I remember.
Isn't it great? I mean, I love memoirs. I love memoirs that kind of engage with all these questions. Like,
I do too.
What is my memory of this event? And what is the fact that it's even solidified as a memory mean? And all of those things, or images that come back to you over and over again. Like, I love it.
It is. It's fascinating. And the way memory works is totally counterproductive to writing a memoir, right? Because the more you recall it, the hazier it gets.
Yes.
But then, like, in revision, as you write a book, you revise and revise and revise. So you're polishing this thing that's, like, disappearing as you polish
it. Right,
right. So it becomes this other thing of its own accord that I don't even know anymore what it has to do with the
nothing.
Event itself.
It has,
right?
Like, nothing to do with the original.
Yeah.
But that is kind of beautiful in
it
a way,
is.
As long as everyone's on the same page, that's what happens.
Yeah.
One of the problems I had writing was that I didn't know how to make memory, which to me is very photographic almost, like a moment. It's mm-hmm. kind of still.
Yeah.
Memories tend to be still as opposed to dynamic or something. I didn't know how to make memory conform to a narrative arc. Like, how do you do that? Because I think of a narrative arc as being one event flowing after another with rising action and conflicts
and
that
obstacles.
Get in the way and obstacles.
Yeah.
And
so how did you solve that problem as you were writing?
Well, I spoke to an advisor. I said, I'm very frustrated. I'll remember a scene or a moment, and then I don't know what to do because what do I do after that? I don't know how to write it, quote unquote, long. Mm-hmm. You know, how do I keep going? And she goes, just hit the return key a few times. Write the next one. Keep going. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, the return key. And that's what I did for the whole thing, pretty much. There's a lot of white space in that book. But I think it ends up working, and there's that epigram?
Uh-huh.
Which one?
Well, I was confused. Epitaph and epigram. Definitely not epitaph.
there's the quote from Amy Hempel in the beginning that I love.
Will you want to read that?
Yes. Yeah, I will. Thank you. This is from one of those great Paris Review.
Interviews.
Oh,
those are so good.
So this is Amy Hempel. She says, some writers have a more defined sense of cause and effect, plot. My sense of life is more moment, moment, moment. Looking back, they accrue and occur to you at a certain time, and maybe you don't know why, but you trust that they are coming back to you now for a reason, and you make a leap of faith. You trust you can put these moments together and create story. That gave me, like, shivers as I was reading it, because that sort of felt like permission to me to just keep hitting the return key.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, agreed. That quote is, like, totally why I love short story writing. Because short story writing, I feel like, captures moments for me as a writer better and, like, more satisfyingly than anything else.
A novel.
Yes. Yeah. Although memoir can do it as well. If you let it, which I think is why that idea of white space. And I love just, like, keep going, keep going, keep going.
Yeah.
That's right.
And not, like, overthink it too much.
Can
I ask you a question? Like, when you're writing, are you always more drawn to first person than third?
Yes.
You almost always write in
almost
first person.
Almost always. Yeah.
And do you ever feel limited by that?
No, I feel the opposite. I feel limited writing in third. Yeah. I'll sometimes write in second. Like, I can pull second off to get away from my brain,
mm-hmm.
but I feel much more, I can, like, own a character much better in first. I just feel like it like brings the reader in quicker
mm-hmm.
into a point of view, but mostly just that's how I feel comfortable writing from inside a character. I feel much freer. Third person feels like phony when I do it myself. I just feel like I'm pretending to write in a way I don't naturally.
Right.
But that's just me.
Well, it's interesting because when I've tried to write in third person, I want to. I'm going to keep trying, but it always feels like I'm pretending to know everything.
Yeah.
And
in first or in third?
In third.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Like the limited knowledge of a particular person.
Like a close-in third point of view.
Yeah. Or even first.
Yeah.
Feels comfortable and allowable to me. But an all-knowing, like, distant third person.
Yeah, omniscient. Yeah.
Feels really phony.
Yeah. Yeah. I once asked Karen Shepherd, you know, the writer Karen Shepherd, mm-hmm. who often writes in omniscient third, how, because I just marvel at how people can do that so well. And her advice was like, oh, well, you just have to find your inner know-it-all.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Like, that's right.
Yeah.
But then I feel like weirdly it goes back to what is allowable in a way. And I think there is part of me that's like, well, I'm not allowed to know what that person's thinking. And even though I think it would probably be really fun, but there is a part of me that's just like a stop of like, I can know this much.
Right.
And so that's what I'm going to write about.
Well, this brings me back to Allison Conley and some of the things that, you know, what did I get to know about her as I was writing. In some ways, I thought, you know, not all of my mom's advice is good. Like, some
ooh,
of it
give me some bad
is
ones.
Bad.
Oh, good. Can we please have some of those?
Well, like, one thing, so related to this, on one hand, I think this is true. And on the other hand, I'm like, she used to say, the smarter you are, the more you're willing to admit you don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's good advice in the sense that it encourages curiosity and encourages people to ask questions and seek new information. Mm-hmm. But I think it's kind of bad advice in the sense that taken too far, it encourages like a real doubting sense. And I think I have totally internalized a real doubting sense. Mm-hmm. Like I have a... why is that? Like a constant, like, why? And yeah. We were talking about, you know, writing as a quest or like writing to discover something in nonfiction. Like that is very much something that I do. So I would like to know my inner know-it-all a little bit more,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to try.
Okay, so talking about the imperfections of your mom, I really want to, I have like three favorite passages in the book, but one of them is this not long paragraph that just starts of like, it's like some of her flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder if I can have you read that.
Sure. Some of her flaws. She was helpless and avoidant. Oh, I didn't get your message, she'd say, when what she meant was she hadn't listened to it. She thought her tax bill a personal attack. She was both a know-it-all and an unreliable source, a dramatic arc more important than fact. Oh, I don't know anything, she'd demur if challenged. She whined. She was so practical she could be tone-deaf. But I love him, I might say, over a heartbreak, and she became a deli counter employee. Next, she said. And though she called my stepfather pathologically optimistic, she must have also seen brighter things ahead. These are less her flaws. So should I stop there?
Yeah. If you want. So my question about that passage is, did you, it's a kind of a craft question, a revision question. So did you write that, like, did that come naturally? Were you just like, I got to have a section about her flaws or like, I want to?
Mm.
Or was that like an editor revision thing of like, we got to have, like, she can't be this good.
No, that was me because, and that came naturally because I think about this a lot. We had this lovely Unitarian minister who came right after she died and he wanted to hear stories about her so that he could, you know, talk at the funeral. And we told all these great things. Oh, she's such a great mom, blah, blah, blah. And then he was like, okay, but what did she do that annoyed you? And I loved him for asking that question because we all had something to say. And she was maddening. Like, it was so annoying to have that, like, sort of the way she wouldn't take personal responsibility for things. Like, oh, I didn't get your message. It's like, what? So that all came naturally. And I'm irritated by her. You know, she was irritating.
I love that answer because I feel like that dichotomy is so captured in the book as a whole. It's like it's a book that's about a marriage falling apart and like a like lovely, revered parent dying. And yet the book is filled from like beginning to end with these like moments of sensuality and joy in food and sex and like a body and like a place. Like, place is so evocative in this book. And I feel like in many ways, like, the book as a whole, really from beginning to end, really ends up, like, beginning and ending with this sense of, like, holding both at the same time. Like, there is no Like, it's not just hot potato back and forth. There is a sense of, like, really, you hold them at the same time. And that is sort of, like, the secret of it all. And I love that. And so I think it's so wonderful that that also was, like, your experience as a child.
Well, optimistic pessimist, right?
Totally.
Or depressive optimist.
Right.
I mean, both are true.
Yeah.
I mean, I think how annoying I would be if, and I think about it a lot, like, oh my God, I must be really annoying to people who think I'm just like living in a joy state or something all the time. But I'm not. I'm like really grumpy and irritable and anxious. And I want to be able to talk about those things too. Mm-hmm. And I guess to your point, what I love about that passage and the portrait of my mother as a whole is that, you know, I've been thinking about Mary Oliver a lot lately. You know, I think I'm going to paraphrase it, but the line, it's like, you do not have to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's this woman in my book who she's flawed. She's totally flawed. And she gave bad advice. And she taught me a sort of limited idea of what it means to be a woman. But I love her so much, and I think she was a wonderful mother, and both are true.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm happy about that.
Yeah. So, of course, the question I want to ask, and probably other people want to know, is what else are you working on? What project do you feel like is coming up next for you?
I want to write a novel. I have many pages of something. It's a giant mess.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
It is.
So yeah, fiction.
Yeah.
I'm trying fiction.
Yeah. And is that a comfortable like move back and forth for you? Or are you like the ice skater on the...
No. Well, I mean, I've never really done it before.
Yeah.
It's just, I think what is so fun about being a writer or a creative person at all is anytime I learn, oh, so-and-so wrote a play, or, you know, this person did this performative, they did a performance at a museum where they picked up a telephone and, like, listened to people and then wrote on receipts little fortunes or whatever. I get so excited because I want to do all the things, you know,
yep.
So... You get it.
I totally get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to write a novel. No, it's not comfortable. No, I have no idea what I'm doing. But I got that book used to write Eileen, the 90-day novel. And it's so far, it's really fun. I only did day one. And then and then it was like tour started, real life got in the way. But I know it's there waiting for me to go back to.
The 89 days.
The 89 days just stretch before me.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
They'll just wait around. It's okay.
But going from short stories to novel for you, is that a comfortable
No,
switch?
Very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I've done, I have a first draft. But it's also a mess.
Yeah.
But it's great. Like, it's fun. Short stories for me are like, I feel like I'm building like a teeny tiny miniature terrarium that has to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so writing a novel, I just was like, I'm going to break every rule I have about writing a short story and do the opposite.
Oh, cool.
And it was wonderful. Like, I could not wait to sit down every day, even if it was like 11 o'clock at night after I'd been teaching.
Wow.
I was like, I'm doing it. It was great.
Because you felt like you were breaking rules and doing something totally different?
It just wasn't work in the same way.
Mm.
It was more about like, the commitment to just keep doing it every day, even if it was like half an hour instead of 2 hours or whatever. And so it just became like, oh, doesn't have to make sense.
Right.
Let's just put words on the page, or let's just like handle that one scene that I know is coming that I keep putting off. Like,
I feel that.
Yeah.
I feel that sense of, you know, even with day one, I did day one, but you know, I have other material before the book, but like, yeah, just kind of like running with it a little bit, and that sense of like wildness
without a like I like that there was no it's not like the fin it's not about the finish line, it was just about the running.
But do you okay sorry I know I'm like asking a lot of questions now, but I'm curious, do you one thing I love about your writing is just its incredible economy. Do you write messy first drafts, or with the novel, are you writing a messy first draft?
The novel is a messy first draft.
Yeah.
With short stories, I tend to be a little bit more, I try and start at a more minimalist place. Mm-hmm. But I do, depends on it. I mean, there are times when I get messy, but I do, if I like to keep things organized because if I don't, if I allow myself to be messy, I get really messy.
Yeah.
But so that's why with the novel, I was like, I'm going to do it different. I didn't want control in the same way. And I shouldn't have, right? Novels are very different.
Yeah.
So for me, I guess for me, they are different. That's maybe not true for everybody. Like I heard George Saunders say, like, when he wrote Lincoln and the Bardo, it was like, oh, well, I only know how to write short stories. And so they're like, each one's like a little yurt or something, he said. And so you're just like building yurt after yurt. And so they're connected. Or God, sorry, George, I don't know if that's exactly what you said. But how they just like, oh, I just do what I do. And then they just are connected and they become a thing. And for me, I wanted that to work. Like I set out to do that and it just wasn't true for me.
Mm.
I just needed like... Like in my, it's like a, like high plains, like, and it just stretches on forever.
Wow.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
And so that's what it was for me. And so I'm just letting that be okay. I'm allowing that to be okay.
You're giving yourself permission. It's all allowable.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mrs. McCall.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Allison.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for talking with me and being here. And you're wonderful. And Joy Enough is such a beautiful book. And I feel like gift to yourself and women everywhere and readers about how we can be in the world and as messy and beautiful as that is. So thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. I adore you, as you know.
Yeah.
So this has been just a dream. Thank you.
You've been listening to Sarah McCall, author of the new memoir, Joy Enough, in conversation with Margaret Malone, author of the story collection, People Like You. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Sarah and Margaret for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
The sweetest gift of love.